you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 67 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Totman, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And after last week's dander along the banks of the beautiful River Dodder, we are back in our usual halls of residence here in Dundrum in our recording studio. And last week was great. It was great because we enjoyed our environs. We were talking about the landscape of Milltown Golf Club, but in particular, District Court Judge Olan Kelleher. What an interview he gave us.
Yeah, he's a real class act.
Leaside legend I refer to, and I think it was really appropriate. He gave his city and county some service, 14 years on the bench.
Yeah.
And we got great reaction to that during the week. Clio is the leading provider of cloud-based legal practice management software, providing lawyers with an easy-to-set-up, affordable solution to manage and grow your firm more effectively, more profitably, and with better client experiences. Start a free trial today. Visit clio.com/IE. Well, today we are going to be discussing some of the matters which would have come before Olan in his court in Cork on a regular basis, that being prosecutions for drink and very much these days prosecutions for drug driving no less, Mark. And we're going to be joined by retired Garda Sergeant Michael Daly, who is now a barrister and who has written the definitive book in this area, an incredible book on drink and drug driving in Ireland. And I am really looking forward to talking to him today.
Yeah, I mean, there's real developments there. I mean, drug driving was hardly even prosecutable a few years ago, whereas now they've got quite sophisticated tests, I think.
Did you ever have to blow into the bag?
Never, no.
Never? Had to a couple of occasions. Thankfully, all was okay, but no, definitely had to do it. And it'll put the fear of God into you. But anyway, there you go. But first to three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website, and we are starting with a property dispute which concerned a mortgagee's sale to purchasers, which was upheld despite the absence of a court order for possession. The Court of Appeal held that despite the absence of a court order, the purchaser had obtained good title to the property. This is the case of Lanigan versus the Property Registration Authority of Ireland. And it's a Court of Appeal decision of Ms. Justice Nuala Butler.
Yeah, it's actually Langan and the Property Registration Authority, not Lanigan. And yeah, in a lot of cases when mortgagees are selling in possession, they have court orders. And this is just one where the appellant or the mortgagor whose title had been lost said, you couldn't possibly sell this property, you didn't have a court order. But in fact, there are many ways that a mortgagee can acquire title without a court order. And in this case, Ms. Justice Butler was quite satisfied that the statutory protections that the had all been dealt with and that they were in a position to sell the property.
Okay, so Mr. Langan was all yes. Good, as in Dave, famous yes. Man who used to play on the wing for Ireland all those
years ago. I'll take
your
word for it.
Okay, Mark, next to matters to do with the labour movement and the right of workers to withhold their labour where necessary. This is a case which went all the way to the Supreme Court, and giving judgment on behalf of the court, the Chief Justice, Mr. Justice Donal O'Donnell, held that the High Court should not have granted an interlocutory injunction to restrain industrial action. This is the case of H.A. O'Neill Limited versus Unite the Union. And it's a Supreme Court decision with Mr. Justice Donal O'Donnell giving the leading decision.
Yeah, so, I mean, complicated issue here. And as many people will know, under the sort of various partnership agreements, you can have these agreements between unions and employers where you effectively say there will be no strike action. And there had been such an agreement in this case. And yet the members had been balloted and a strike action did go ahead. So that the company then applied for an interlocutory injunction, which was granted in the High Court. But the particular legislation, which is the Industrial Relations Act 1990, basically just sets out four criteria for strike action. And all of those had been met. So whatever the existence of the agreement between the union and the employer, it was not sufficient for the employer to get an interlocutory injunction.
Yes.
And so although the overall case was moot, the specific issue
they
of the industry...
They satisfied the various tests under the industrial relations law, and they were allowed to strike and protest and withdraw their labour, no doubt. Yeah. Okay, finally, to a dispute over the purchase of an apartment in Italy, no less, Mark. The High Court refused to grant summary judgment to plaintiffs in the sum of €127,400. This was paid in anticipation of a contract to purchase an apartment in Italy on the grounds that the defendants had raised a number of defences. And this is the case of Lee versus Lee. Sounds like a kung fu movie. But anyway,
it is
a decision of Mr. Justice Conleth Bradley.
Yeah.
Enter the dragon.
As you can probably tell, this is a dispute between family members. And what one member of the family said that he would buy an apartment for that the other one could invest in. And the payee, the one seeking to purchase, paid over $127,400, but never got title to the apartment. And so eventually they sued for their money back. And what the defendant said was, you paid the money and you have had access to the apartment since then. So the fact that no actual contract had come into being didn't necessarily mean that they were entitled to their money back straight away. And Mr. Justice Bradley was satisfied that there was a dispute that needed to be resolved at full hearing and it couldn't be disposed of by way of summary judgment.
Okay, very good. It had to be a full plenary hearing with witnesses and everybody who could contribute in order that a decision could be made. Brilliantly explained, Mark. We're back shortly with Barrister Michael Daly.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to the studio retired Garda, retired Sergeant Michael Daly, who has joined us in the Law Library. How long have you been practising in the Law Library now, Michael?
This is my third year.
Third year, okay.
Yes.
And enjoying it?
Absolutely.
The force was never like this, was it?
No, not really.
Okay, well, you've had a wonderful career in the Guards, and I know you're having a wonderful career in the Law Library, and you've written this incredible book, Drink and Drug Driving in Ireland. And I mean, this is the definitive guide in relation to this, Michael. So we're going to talk all about that. And we'll get into the book and the law in relation to this particular area very soon. But first, tell us about your background. So you were a guard, you have a full career in the Guards?
I spent 37 years in the Guards. And I started off in Dublin in a number of stations. And I moved to the Garda College in Templemore, where I was involved in training students. And then I subsequently, even though I was based in Templemore, I was attached to the legal section in the Guards. I would have went out, say, done a lot of lectures with different unit sections in the Guards. So, yeah, broad experience of the Guards in general.
And where are you? What county man are you?
Well, that's a very good question. I was born in Mayo. We lived there for a good few years in Newport, where my father was from.
Oh, beautiful part of the world.
Correct.
Famous for Grace Kelly.
Absolutely, and the Greenway. Then we moved to Monaghan for a few years in a place called Shantana. Then we moved to Dublin, and I've been living in Tipperary for a number of years since. So
you're like Charlie Hoey.
Well, sort of. And then due to family commitments, I spent a lot of time in Donegal.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I know that. And when I was trying to get you, you were in Donegal at the time.
Correct.
So I'm aware of that. So you joined the Guards. Why become a guard, Michael?
Well, I don't know really. My father was a guard. It was just the thing that always interested me. So I applied and I got into it. And one of them things that you sort of want to do from an early age. And that was basically it.
Okay. And you have taught in Templemore. And I know the recruitment process for guards are slightly different from maybe when you joined.
Correct.
It was only 6 months.
6 months, 22 weeks, yeah. And then you were put back out and that was it. And you just learned as you went along from more senior people and that was it.
And where were you assigned? Were you sent up to Dublin, up to the big smoke?
Yeah, absolutely. I was in Kevin Street. Then it was in Blanchardstown and Cabra.
Okay. Yeah. And what was that like as a raw Garda recruit?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's like everything. Everything is a culture shock. I suppose you're seeing people at their best and at their worst. And I suppose you see every facet of life, basically. People in trouble, people in difficulties, all types of human problems, really.
Yeah, but very rewarding work, isn't it?
In ways, yeah, it would be. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean... Like, if you pick up the papers now and you see certain votes by the Garda, you know, representative association, etc., sounds like there's a bit of discontent in among the force at the moment. I'm not asking you to get into that. We don't want to get overly political.
Okay.
But I mean, in terms of day-to-day Garda duties, I mean, guards that I know, they seem to really love the work.
They do, but I suppose the oversight and the discipline would be the two big issues. And I mean, I'm not talking out of turn here. The rep bodies have been on about that for quite a long time. And there's quite a bit of bureaucracy.
There does have to be oversight, isn't there? I mean, you know, you're giving huge powers to individuals that ordinary citizens wouldn't have. I mean, they need to be kept in line. And obviously, there probably isn't a police force in the world that hasn't got a few bad apples that...
Oh yeah,
you know. I mean, is it worse here? Do you think than other countries?
I wouldn't think so.
Right.
In my years in the guards, no, I couldn't say.
But
that.
Do you mean? But I mean, the oversight. Do you think that's worse here?
It seems to be very bad at the moment.
Right.
There seems to be just complete oversight. There doesn't seem to be any room for initiative. If you seem to do anything that's outside parameter set in relation to a policy, it just seems to be that you're going to be in trouble straight away. End of story.
Yeah, I mean, there's some extraordinary judicial reviews.
Even if you look at the judicial reviews in the courts in the last few years, you will see that quite a number of them have been lost. The judiciary seem to be stepping in there is all that going on.
Well, we're probably stepping into territory that we shouldn't, Michael, so that we might steer you back to the issue de jure, which is your wonderful book. But before we get to that, you tell me about the Garda College in Templemore. You taught there for years.
I did,
Your experience of that. I mean, people are fascinated by Templemore. What goes on there?
Well, I mean, it's basically, you see every aspect of human life, I suppose. Guards are drawn from the community at large. So you have people from cities, you have people from country areas, you have people with trades, you have people with degrees, you have people with every type of thing that's possible that you could imagine. And I think what a lot of people forget is inside the gates, they're actually people. People see the Garda College as this place where you're churned out and you become a guard, but they're actually human beings. And it's like everybody you meet in life. There's people you get on with, there's people you don't get on with, there's people with particular idiosyncrasies, and that's all catered for. And
just more recently, I mean, that old expression you get in the country is, you're a young fella growing up, you'll make the guards if you start sprouting at all. That obviously that's gone. I mean, the height requirement is well and truly gone. And the idea was, I suppose, that, you know, the guards should reflect society. You know, you should have kind of tall, small, large, skinny, whatever it is, and it should reflect all and different diversity and stuff like that. And that's your experience in the Garda College.
Absolutely. And especially in the last few years, say with height restrictions removed, all that type of stuff. And even you look at the amount of guards we have from foreign countries, you go into any district court, and I'm in district courts all over the country, you'll see when a guard's name is being called and it's unusual, you can see the court staff struggling to pronounce it, as we all do, because normally it was Murphy, Jordan, some name like that, but now it's, you know.
It could be any name under
the
sun.
It could be any name under the sun.
And it is a good thing, and it reflects the modern Ireland.
And again, with that, I mean, the guards have moved where everybody is included, you know, from every nationality that they can. And that, you know, so no, it's,
that's for,
I think
for,
we have moved.
Yeah, yeah. No,
we reflect society, basically.
Absolutely, and that's it. And now, sorry, go on, Mark, please.
Can I ask, before you decided to become a barrister, had you much prosecuting experience? I mean, is that something you would have done on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, well, I think most guards would be in court, quite obviously the big difference at the moment, you go into court as a guard, okay, you prosecute your own case in Dublin, an inspector in the country prosecutes it.
Yeah.
If you're going into the circuit court, the DPP will do it. The big change that I have found is, as a barrister, you now go on this side, you have to do everything.
Yeah.
All you had to do as a guard, you rock up and you give your evidence. All the background stuff is done. Now you're in a position where the background stuff isn't done. You have to do it. And I found that actually quite interesting. Mm. Say all the regulations in relation to time limits and all that. All you really, as a guard, you're concerned with is summary offences, 6 months time limit, or hybrid offences, or either way offences, as I prefer to call them. But you have to do all this background yourself now.
Is that something you wish you'd known as a guard?
Well, you don't need to know it, so it doesn't affect you. Yeah. You have the DPP, you have state solicitors who do all that, so you don't need to know it, so it doesn't enter on your radar.
Sure.
But at this stage, like that to me now would be, you know, by the time you get into court, that's only the final end of it. As both of you are practicing barristers, you know exactly what I'm saying. You have to have the background done.
Sure.
Okay, Michael, and just one thing before we get into the book. I mean, what is it like being sort of poacher turned gamekeeper? I mean, that's probably an unfortunate phrase to use.
It's not the other way around.
Gamekeeper turned poacher. Well, maybe that's it. Maybe it's the inverse. But I mean, how do you feel? I mean, you're going up against the guards nowadays. You're representing people. You're representing people that you would have been prosecuting a little while ago. Well, so how does that feel?
Well, no difficulty with it, really. I mean, when you were in the guards, you were paid to do a particular job. Now I'm on the other side, I'm paid to do a particular job. So, I mean, I don't have a difficulty with it. And I think most of my ex-colleagues would see it as well, that it's a job. And I think most guards are big enough to see that.
And there's a wonderful tradition in the law library of people who are former guards coming down, who qualified many years ago and then coming down maybe slightly later in life.
So, yeah.
And practicing and being great and being really into it. Mark, you would know plenty of people like that, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to the bite. You're only practicing 3 years.
Correct.
And yet you have produced this incredibly weighty tome. This is a big book. This is a big book. A lot of work went into it. So what made you write this book,
well,
Michael?
I suppose that I was, the Garda Guide, which is the book of all regulations. It was a book all criminal practitioners, and it was in every office, solicitor's office in the country. I was involved in producing that. And at the time, my inspector was Joe Ward, who was a barrister, since deceased, lovely man. But Joe, I was one of the co-authors of it. Joe was putting this together and I was in the team with him, and I just got an interest in it. And as Joe always said to me, he says, the point about it is you have to make the law understandable. It rules everybody's lives, and it would have been greatly influenced by him. So I'd been through the process of producing as one of the co-authors of the Garda Guide. So I had all this knowledge when I came out of the guards in relation to drunk driving. And I just said one day, do you know what? I'll just put this down on paper. And it was more a manual I started for myself, but it morphed into an actual textbook.
Yeah.
And that's actually how it started.
Well, look, I mean, it's an incredible piece of work, Michael. And okay, let's stick with drunk driving, because obviously it's drink driving and drug driving. But let's go back to the old drink driving. You know, we had only last week on this show, we had the great Olan Kelleher, retired district court judge from Cork. And Mark asked him at one point, I think it is Mark, you asked him, you know, was there any area of law that you were concerned about or that caused you anxiety? And he said, drink driving. Oh. And he talked about fat cats coming all the way down from Dublin down to Cork. I don't know what he was talking about. But anyway, you know, because there's fat cats everywhere, I would have thought. But anyway, he talked about the fact that, you know, that was an area of law. It was very technical and it was something that put him under pressure. Okay. So it's a very technical area of law to start with.
It is. And I think even if you look back at that famous case, the DPP versus Stewart, where President Kearns, the High Court, said it's something about the ingenuity of Irish lawyers in relation to drunk driving. And I think it is. And of course, the reason quite obviously is if you're convicted of drunk driving, there's a mandatory disqualification in your driving licence. Now, again, with that, most of us, when our driving licence comes up for renewal, you're saying, oh, hassle of having to say you have to send in a form or you have to get a photograph or something. And most people... But I would say to any person, and I say this to everybody, think about it if you lost your license in the next 14 days. And that is the thing, why it is there is so much of this being fought. It's the losing of the license. The amount of people who would say to me, both as an ex-guard and as a barrister, I would pay 10,000, 100,000, no problem, to lose your license. And especially in rural areas where there is no public transport, it is a huge imposition.
Okay.
And when you say it's a huge imposition, do you think it is a proportionate imposition? Or do you think, I mean, is there a problem there that people who are a little bit over the limit suddenly lose their license for a number of years?
Well, it's graded, depending on your reading, for is it breath, blood, urine? So it is graded. So the legislature takes that into account quite obviously. It is a very serious offence. I mean, any of us who were guards at that, we've all been to bad accidents. If you see at your door at 4 in the morning, two bright fluorescent jackets, and it's the guards. You know, it's not to tell you, you've won the lottery.
Yeah.
So, you know, people lose their lives in this. There are very serious injuries in it. Yeah. So there has to be some response.
Yeah, yeah.
But then,
as you say, people will go to extraordinary lengths to avoid having to pay that penalty.
Correct, yeah. Mm. The money is never the problem in the drunk driving. It is, and it's people from all walks of life who are caught in relation to it, you know. So you lose your license. If you just think about it, imagine losing your license
for two to four years.
Yeah. And that is why it's so well fought. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Michael, let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to the rudiments of this, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm out driving the car, okay? Mm. And the next minute I see a guard with a kind of a shiny stick and he's gesturing me into the side. and I know it's going to be a breath test. Will you take it from there? What's happening there?
Okay. Well, the breath test, so they can do two things, okay? They can basically, he quite obviously, or she will ask you for your driving license, they'll have a conversation, they will get a smell of breath off you, your eyes are glazed. There's the usual indicative things that you have been drinking. So the guard may decide, okay, he may ask you for to blow into what's called the Draeger now, okay? Years ago, it was the bag that you'd be familiar with, the old alkalizer. We now have a digital one. So it's a failure pass, all right? So it'll show whether or not you have alcohol in your system. There also is a second Draeger where they can test for four types of drugs now, okay? Now that machine, the Draeger, without getting too technical, they stopped using that, and they now have the little drug wipe that they rub around your mouth that went out in, say, December of last year. So you can be checked for alcohol, you can be checked for drugs. So there's a number of offences that you can possibly commit in relation.
And they're now able to check sort of summarily for drugs like cannabis or cocaine?
Correct.
Or?
There's four of them, cannabis, cocaine, heroin, and benzodiazepines.
Right.
And basically, there's limits now set for them. So you ask the person for, they say it's a saliva swab, and it'll come up, there's two little markers, and it'll show what drug you have in your system. Okay. And there's a new procedure then brought in relation to testing for drugs, where you can just ask for blood on its own. With alcohol, it's generally you must give blood, or at your option, urine. It gets very technical, actually, in relation to what you absolutely. But an interesting point you make there, Peter, you see the guard with the flashing stick. The amount of people over the years I've heard that have said to me, oh, the guards pulled me over, and the lights, they really were strong lights, blue flashing lights. And of course, they'd say to you, I got such a hop, but quite obviously there's a statutory instrument governing blue lights, okay? Mm-hmm. Blue lights on a number of vehicles, emergency vehicles, they must be 40 watts. Amber lights must be 25 watts. So if you see a tractor on the road, the light isn't as intensive.
Yeah.
But the amount of people have said to me, God, the lights the guards had seemed very strong.
Yeah. And well, that's all is the part reason. Of the,
Yeah.
But it is a big deal. You're pulled over to the side. Now, you're saying that the guard will form a view, you know, an opinion on the basis of smelling breath, for example, okay? But they don't really need to do that. I mean, is it not automatic these days? You just bring over kind of five cars or whatever, and they test everybody, automatically test people.
Yeah, that's what's called, that was provided for in the road traffic. It's called a mandatory intoxicant checkpoint. And an inspector has to authorise that. In that case, they can pull you over. They don't need to have any suspicion. But in the normal case, say if you're out and you see a car wobbling all over the road, you would have to form an opinion.
Yes.
Okay. But without getting too technical, the intoxicant checkpoints, the super checkpoints they're called, you'd see them, they could have 20 guards on them, and there's cars pulled in, you'll be tested generally for alcohol, you'll also be tested for drugs.
Okay, so John Doe blows into the Draeger.
The Draeger.
And, you know, bing, a reading comes up and the guards say, this man is over the limit.
Well,
what happens next?
It's not a reading, he'll either pass or fail.
Fails, okay.
Okay, so the guard then can take that into his account to form his opinion that the person is under the influence of an intoxicant to such an extent as to have improper control of a mechanically propelled vehicle. He arrests him under section 4.8. That relates to intoxicant, so he's brought back to the station. If it's alcohol thereafter, they'll ask you they might ask you to give a breath specimen, okay, where you blow into the evidenzer, all right, where you give two breath samples, you get what's called, as I like to refer to it as, a till roll receipt, and it'll show, you give two samples of breath, they will reduce the level of one of the breaths to make sure that the person gets the best chance possible, okay, it's provided for in the legislation, the guard signs it, you sign it, that's your evidence. In that case, what you'll do is they'll charge you on a charge sheet, you'll be brought before a court. In some stations, what they may do is they'll bring you in and they'll ask you for your blood or at your option urine. Okay, a doctor or a nurse now will take it. That'll be sent to the Medical Bureau of Road Safety. Quite obviously, you haven't your evidence at that stage, so the person is released and they'll be summoned at a later date. But there is nothing to stop the guards in that situation asking for a breath sample and or a blood or urine sample.
Okay, and what about if I say, you know, my civil liberties are being infringed here, Michael, and I don't want to give a sample, and I'm saying that, you know, I'm not going to cooperate with this, and I'm an innocent person until proven guilty.
Yes, and that's quite an interesting one. In relation to the way the legislation is drawn up, if you refuse to give a sample, you are automatically, if you're convicted of a refusal or failure, put on the maximum amount of disqualification, which is automatically 4 years. Now, another point in relation to that, Dermot Walsh wrote the foreword to my book.
Yes, and, which is brilliant. It's a really interesting, actually. And he raises all those civil liberties arguments.
He does, yes. And that's where, and he was one of my lecturers when I undertook the LLB in Limerick. And Dermot Walsh, in the foreword to the book, makes that point. He said, society just accepts it. If a guard came up to you in the street and says, give me a sample of saliva, as you say, Peter, you would have a difficulty with it. And he does make that point, but we just accept it as for a greater good. So he says, right, this is what we have.
And there is the social contract. We're all out there in cars. We need people to obey the rules.
Correct.
But not only that. I mean, we drive, we're given licenses to drive. And one of the conditions of driving is that we don't drink or take drugs, and that we subject ourselves to tests when the guard wants it to.
Isn't that correct?
The,
absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, the civil liberties thing is a bit pie in the sky. It's a, you know, it's in the same way as when we get in an aeroplane, we don't complain about having our bags searched.
Civil liberties been pie in the sky?
No, but in relation to driving a car, I mean, the time that your average citizen is most likely to be responsible for killing or injuring another person is when they're behind the wheel of a car.
Yes,
isn't that
correct.
Right?
Absolutely.
Well, then you see, and if you follow the criminal law, you will see that where somebody's brought in for a crime, you have to get permission from a higher ranking officer to take intimate and non-intimate samples. You don't in the case of drunk driving.
Yeah.
Okay, now, you're unlikely in a way to go to prison for drink driving offence unless somebody is very seriously injured or ends up before the circuit court or you're a recidivist in the district court. Mm. So I suppose that feeds into it as well, but it is a fair point you make, Peter, right?
Yeah, yeah. So Michael, there I am in the cell, scratching my head, saying, why did I have that second pint? Why did I have that third pint? And now my life is ruined. I'm off the road and it could cost me my job. And,
and
the consequences are huge for somebody. So I said, God, how do I save the day? How do I save the day? So I give you a ring now, Michael, and some of your colleagues in the law library. And these are the lawyers that Olin Kelleher was talking about coming down. So you have to represent people who've been caught, I would have thought, fairly and squarely. So what do you do?
Well, I suppose as lawyers, all we can ever do is test the evidence that the prosecution has. And I mean, that is the function of a lawyer. I mean, it's not up to me to judge whether the person was over the limit or not.
Absolutely.
That's up to the judge in the case. All I can do, or any barrister can do, and you're both barristers yourselves, you can only ask the prosecution what they have. I mean, it's the whole weight of the state coming down on an individual. Okay, so the only thing that they have is somebody who understands the law. All right, so all you're doing is testing the prosecution evidence, and that's throughout any legal system.
You're raising a reasonable doubt, isn't that?
Correct. Yeah, you know that there some procedure hasn't to be complied with. Mm.
But to pick up on your reference, and you referred to the decision of Mr. Justice Kearns in DPP. What's the case again? DPP and Stewart. And I notice, again, another foreward written in your book, an excellent foreword by Gráinne Malone, District Court Judge.
Gráinne Malone, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, 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 very well-known District Court Judge. Right. And she talks about the ingenuity and the creativity and the extent to which lawyers come up with defences in this area.
Yeah, and again, as she makes the point, it's the mandatory disqualification, you know. Mm. And again, she goes on that the function of the courts there is to balance the right for the public to see somebody prosecuted and to ensure that the rights of the person, and that's always going to be the issue in law.
Okay.
So that's, I suppose, where...
But isn't there law out there which says, I mean, before I get to that, can we go back to what happens? Like, what are you testing? When somebody gives you a file and says, look, I've failed the breathalyzer, you know, I went back, they did a test in the Garda station and, you know, I've gone down and I'm terrified of losing my license. You know, what are you look? What when you go through the file? What are you looking for, Michael?
Don't
have to give away all your trade secrets.
No,
but just,
I don't.
You know.
I suppose 37 years' experience of being a guard and then being a lawyer and having worked in the legal section in the guards. It could be anything.
Yes. Okay.
It could be. It just literally can be anything. I mean, you know, but, I mean, you're not going to get it. You can't save everybody.
What about these? Like, I mean, I don't know anything about this, but what about, I hear about temperatures in the room.
Well, all that's gone, yeah.
That's all gone.
That's all gone, yeah. That's all gone.
And what about
and
time 20 delays?
Minute observation. 20
minutes, 20 yeah.
minute observation. And there's a case actually at the moment, which you'd possibly be familiar with. The 20-minute yeah. observation period is to make sure you take nil by mouth. And yeah. that's in favour of the accused person.
Sure.
And as Murray, the Chief Justice Murray said, it's not a detention, but it's an aid of the person.
Yeah.
All right. So the 20 minutes is an observation period carried out. Now, the main challenge at the moment in relation to the drug driving legislation, and there's a case, and I understand it's gone to the Supreme Court, where when we do the drug wipe, or my ex-colleagues do the drug wipe, it could take 8 minutes for cannabis and up to 20 for a heroin result to come back. And in one of the recent cases, it was held that there was no power for the guards to detain the person for that time. And my understanding is that that's gone to the Supreme Court. So that'll be interesting, but that's in relation to drugs.
Okay. So and the drugs thing, that creates a lot of interesting questions. I mean, obviously, we talked about the fact that there is a social contract and people have licenses driving cars, and therefore it's in everybody's interest that people obey the law and
correct.
Don't pose a danger to their fellow citizens who are in cars or walking pedestrians or whatever they are. But in terms of drugs, I mean, there's two aspects there. First of all, you can be over the limit.
Correct.
But B, you shouldn't be taking drugs anyway. So you're automatically guilty of a criminal offence, are you not?
Well, I suppose the thing about it is there's in the more recent Road Traffic Act, there's limits set for those drugs, cannabis, heroin, that I mentioned earlier. Okay.
So if I have taken cocaine, I could have an acceptable limit, level of
correct.
Cocaine.
Absolutely. Well. But before, okay.
Kind of beggar's belief a little bit, but anyway.
Well, it doesn't really, because
yeah,
the
no,
second part to that is that quite obviously the guards can prosecute a person where they're under the influence and intoxicant to such an extent as to be incapable of having proper control of a mechanically propelled vehicle. So you might have taken some drug.
Okay, that's the context,
yeah,
yes.
You might be under the limit for the Draeger, but I could still form the opinion that you are not fit to drive and I could still prosecute you.
Okay.
So there's basically the easiest way to explain it to your listeners is there's two ways drugs prosecutions can come. One is a concentration offence. There's a limit set. And the other is the more general one that we'd all be familiar with, where person was walking the line, finger to nose test, and you have to prove incapability. More problematic for the prosecution to prove, quite obviously. The other one where you blow into the, or the medical bureau does the analysis, you come back with a cert, they show you're over the limit. It's way easier for the guards.
Can I ask you then about the Draeger machine? Because one of the things that I think everybody's heard about now is the post office prosecutions in the UK.
Correct.
Where basically their computers that were clearly at fault that resulted
yes.
in hundreds of wrongful prosecutions.
Correct.
Now, when we're prosecuting, when you're prosecuting or the member of the guards is prosecuting somebody for drunk driving or drug driving, you're relying on the evidence from a machine.
Correct.
And obviously, machines can be faulty. Is there any danger that we might find that somewhere down the road, it turns out that these machines are not all they're cracked up to be and that a lot of people were wrongfully prosecuted?
Well, I don't think so. It would be my own view. And I'll tell you why. The Medical Bureau for Road Safety tests these, and I would have been involved with them. They're a very, very professional group. They do an awful lot of surveys, all that type of stuff, checking equipment. They take back the Draegers from the Gardaí. I think it's once every 6 months. They recalibrate them. There's a huge backstory to how these machines operate. Now, there was the famous Ashley McGonnell case where that issue came up where they were saying it was conviction by printout. Mm. And it's quite obviously open to anyone, if they feel that their machine is faulty, to challenge that in court. Mm. But you don't see that a lot in practice.
But do you have sufficient information about the machine when you are challenging it?
Yes.
I mean, if you compare three different machines and you find one of them seems to have convicted three times as much as the other two, would that be an indication that there was a problem with it?
Not necessarily, no, because the Medical Bureau would come to court and they would be able to show the process they use to make sure that the machines were calibrated, they were in perfect working order, they're checked regularly. I must say, of anything that I've seen, they really keep a very good eye on them.
I mean, 6 months doesn't sound that often. I mean, you know, something could easily go wrong after a couple of months.
Well, there's inbuilt features into the machines, the evidence or where you're brought into the station, where you blow into it, or the Draeger, that they won't operate under certain conditions. So even, and without getting too technical, even with the alcohol, if there's mouth alcohol, it won't give you a result. So, you know, he has mouth alcohol. I need to wait 20 minutes. Right. There's a lot of inbuilt stuff in that. Sure. Can we ever say for definite with machines? No. But I would have faith in the medical bureau. And
can I just ask, these Dräger machines, are they best practice internationally? Are they used in other countries?
They are, yeah. Okay. They're an international, they're internationally recognized. And again, the medical bureau, from what I understand, if you read their reports, they seem to do an awful lot of research in them before they came up. They have scientists, they're out in UCD where all the samples are analyzed. They are a very professional organization, very professional. Okay.
Michael, just to say, and kind of picking up on what Mark is saying, like, you know, can you be 100% sure that these machines are correct? And yeah, very interestingly, you said, like, you know, certain things about room temperature that we used to hear in the good old days and the observation period of 20 minutes. And I noticed, again, referred to by Judge Gráinne Malone in the foreword to your book, she refers to DPP and Avadenai.
Avadenai,
okay. Yes. And this was a decision of Ms. Justice O'Malley, Isolt O'Malley, okay. And she makes this really interesting point. She says, if a breach, this is a quote directly from her decision, if a breach of the statutory procedure is established, but it has no consequences in that no unfairness, prejudice or detriment can be pointed to, then the normal standards applicable to criminal trials would indicate that the evidence is admissible.
Correct.
So all this kind of codology of saying, ah, well, you didn't do this now and you didn't do that, it has to be substantive in order for you to successfully get somebody off on a drink driving charge.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I'm in district courts all around the country and judges are very well up in this. They know. They're dealing with this every day of the week. So your argument has to be well made. You can't just go into court and hope, oh, I might get an opening here. You have to have an actual basis for challenging the decision.
Okay, very good. One final point. You said, very interestingly, you say that a guard, a standard guard, will put in 40 to 60 hours preparing a file in relation to a drink driving case.
Well,
is that correct?
I quote an assistant commissioner who gave that at an Oireachtas committee report.
Wow, but yeah. So much time.
Well, that's what the assistant commissioner said.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. Michael, this has been absolutely brilliant. We've been firing questions at you. Not a bother on you. Really, really, really impressive. We're going to wrap up now and we have a little question to go before we wrap up totally. And this is about the book or the movie. Any book that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Well, I was actually reading quite recently. It's a book by Fintan O'Toole. We Don't Know Ourselves. And basically what he does is he traces from, say, about the 1960s right up, the different things that have happened and how things were happening and how the state and people knew about them but just turned a blind eye. And he applies the academic side to the actual way it was happening on the ground as such. And I found that fascinating. And
he brings in a lot of his own personal experience,
absolutely.
His own personal meeting with Charles McQuaid.
Correct, and that's the one I'm talking about. And he talks about the Ansbacher accounts, that when they brought in dirt, suddenly the amount of people who had offshore accounts flew up and started. Yeah. Everybody knew, but nobody paid any attention. Sure. That's fine. And how we had the double standards. And he used that quite a bit, actually. Yeah. And I found that quite interesting.
In terms of a movie or a TV series, like you can pick Kojak or you can pick Columbo.
No. Well, it's actually funny you should mention, because Mark mentioned the one about the post office. And there was a four-part series done on it.
Yes.
Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And Alan Jones was the actor in it. And they reckon it's the biggest miscarriage of justice. And I follow that. And that would be what when you say a film, I would say a documentary more so was. I found that fascinating. And again, what I found fascinating about that is how one organization can just blanket and say, no, this happened, this happened, this happened. And why there is a need for checks and balances the whole way. Yeah. And again, what I found with that is that there's a royal prerogative, it appears, where the post office could go straight to court. And again, you think of the DPP and the state solicitors, there's a reason for them.
Yes.
And, you know, I just found that fascinating, that even though they knew that this was wrong, they kept on pushing it. And it brings in a lot of questions about morals, ethics, all that type of
stuff.
And
expert evidence.
Expert evidence,
Expert evidence, of course, of course. Michael, this has been a really, really informative interview. It's been great. It's been a very enjoyable interview, but it's been very informative. Thank you for coming in. Okay. Michael Daly, barrister, thank you for coming in and being a guest on the Fifth Court.
Okay, thank you very much.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can I say a huge thank you to Michael Daly, barrister and former Garda sergeant, for that fascinating insight into drink and drug driving. His book is a must for practitioners, yeah. Mark.
And just for anybody who wants to get a hold of it, it's called Drink and Drug Driving in Ireland, Michael Daly BL, published by Lonsdale Law Publishing. And I think you can purchase it directly from the publisher at lonsdalepublishing.com.
Okay, great. Well, it's a superb book. And if this is your area, get it, folks. It really is excellent. So before we go, I would also like to say a big thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroyne, and to Lee Brennan of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for their wonderful work in recording this show. So for me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Topham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.